Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we have two guests who have had rich lives both in the federal government and in civilian life and have very interesting perspectives on what's happening in the country now and what we need to move forward. Donna Edwards served as a congresswoman from Maryland, then traveled the country in her recreation vehicle to deepen her understanding of why people voted for Trump. She is currently a candidate for county executive in Prince George's County, Maryland, and will be our second guest. First up is Gerald Weaver, formerly chief of staff to a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, in fact, the youngest ever, a lobbyist, a lawyer, and an author of two novels, Gospel Prism and more recently, The First Gentleman. And we have him here with us today. Gerald Weaver, welcome to All Together Now.
Hello, Eleanor. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you have a very interesting life, and starting in your career as the youngest chief of staff in the U.S. House, what did you hope to achieve when you went in as chief of staff in Congress?
Well, what I really wanted was to get a Democrat elected who was going to vote right, because that seat was held by a Republican at the time. So it was important for me to make that small change if I could. And then once I was there, to, you know, see that he voted right and see that we did the best thing possible for the country in a progressive way and for the working people.
And what was your experience like? Did that happen?
Capitol Hill is a strange place. It's sort of trite to say that it's not representative, and that's apparent if you look at the floor of the House or Senate and you see nothing but old white men with money. But I mean that in many other ways. Probably another way it was exemplified was how people, how they were very ignorant when it came to what Facebook does and when Mark Zuckerberg testified. They're largely out of touch, and it's mm-hmm. very much a place unto itself. Hillary said it takes a village, and I'm not so sure about that, but, you know, Capitol Hill is very, very much its own village, with patronage jobs and relationships being important and very, very little really getting done. It's a strange thing for a representative democracy to have people there who aren't really representative of the nation.
Right, and well, we're certainly seeing that in how they're voting when it comes to legislation. They're most of them not voting on the behalf of the people who elected them. You know, I'm just reading a fascinating kind of a memoir from Meg Greenfield, who was the editor of the Washington Post for many years. And she talks about Congress and all the people she knew for decades here in this town. And she actually compares Congress kind of like to high school. But you get all the hyper-competitive people in there and, jockeying for position. But that it really takes a very unusual person to have a positive impact and actually stay true to themselves and what they went in there for. Is that kind of resonant with what you experienced?
Oh yeah, exactly. I might even say middle school. It's very cliquish. You know, there's the male equivalent of the mean girls. There's the cool guys. It's difficult to understand how provincial it is in its own way. And I think one of the things that happens is that they're sort of insulated from the voters and the people, and they behave very, very cautiously in a way, and you will rarely see somebody stand out in a way like say Bernie Sanders did when he ran. And in a way, I think Trump stood out too, because the way things just don't get done in Congress, I think, has had a real effect on people. And I perceived this when I wrote the First Gentleman more than, I guess, 4 years ago. You know, the American voters for some time, I've been looking for a politician who's, you know, sort of wants to tear down the old icons. And by that, I mean they are receptive to a politician who punctures the political orthodoxy. And, you know, that has stifled debate on important national issues like war and war on drugs and medical care for the masses. Those things really have no true debate and haven't had it for a long time. I sort of blame the Democrats. And to state it more bluntly, I think because of the way politicians are, people feel that they're being lied to a lot. And the towering irony of this is that Donald Trump appears to be honest to the reality TV crowd simply because he blurts things out that are not processed or canned, even though they're insincere and false. So I think many voters rushed to Sanders to some extent in Trump because they do not seem to be cautiously reiterating what they've been told by their advisors and pollsters, and because they're not the sort of politician that, you know, is currently on Capitol Hill.
Right. Well, let's talk some more about your very interesting novel here, The First Gentleman, which is about the first woman elected president and her husband. And you have in there the main character is this woman, Melinda Sherman, who runs for president. And she's got quite a program. Talk about breaking the orthodoxy and talking about things that aren't talked about. Describe for our listeners kind of the program that your woman presidential candidate runs and wins on.
Yes. The first thing I'll say about her is that it's really important that she's not a politician. And again, I think this may have predicted Trump in a way because, first of all, she's a family person. She's in love with her husband and she's in love with her stepchildren. And politics to her is sort of a second thought, and whereas most politicians is the be-all and end-all. So because of that, she doesn't really care so much if she wins. She just wants to speak the truth. So she's a sort of a thoughtful, progressive, compassionate version of Trump. But she speaks from the heart, and she's does things. For instance, she's from Kentucky, but she says we ought to have a carbon tax, which is like would be a killer to most people in Kentucky. But in an essence, I sort of predict Trump because people look at her and say, oh, she's not a classic politician. She's not afraid to say what she wants. So that makes her a leader. And she also speaks openly about her faith, which is something that it amazes me that the left doesn't do, because as I read, you know, the major religious books, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, you know, they all make a case for progressive liberal politics, but we stay away from that. So, but she's not afraid to do that as well, and basically says things that are not popular and is conceived as being a leader simply because of that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And by the way, my guest last week is someone who works with the Moral Monday movement and working now on the Poor People's Campaign. And he was talking about exactly that, that from his point of view, to be a true Christian, we need to give shelter to the homeless, give food to the hungry, take care of our brethren. And he is kind of amazed at people who claim the Christian mantle but kind of almost use it as a club to beat people up. And so I think you're right there about the faith issues and about the strength that could be for so many people if they talked about what they really did believe.
Right. I think that's absolutely the case. And also I think that, you know, I hope the lesson from my novel and maybe the lesson from Trump is that people who are progressive and liberal should not be afraid to speak those truths, whether or not they're popular. And with luck, they'll be respected for being leaders and standing up for what they believe in. And it's funny you should mention that, you know, it may be a template for how to run for office, because I've had two interesting experiences recently. One was, you know, Connor Lamb won this district in Pennsylvania in a special election as a Democrat, and it was a district that Trump had won by 20%, and he spoke openly about his Catholic faith, and he also sort of staked the ground in a really straightforward way. He was clearly pro-choice in a pro-life district. But he was also, you know, not really serious, heavy-duty gun control, although he stood for some gun control. in a district where that was a contentious issue. And his father called me up after the election and said, you know, Connor's like Melinda Sherman. And I also sent a contribution and a book to Amy McGrath, who's a war hero, female Democratic candidate in Kentucky, and she said the same thing. She said, I feel like this book's about me, because one of the things that I think is real useful for Democrats as well is that we run veterans and we run women. And I think that's happening. I see that happening a great deal here in 2018.
Right. Well, your book is prescient in many ways. I mean, having written it a few years ago, and now here we are, candidates popping up all over the place, not afraid to speak their truth. I had one of the greatest lessons in politics and government ever when I was standing outside the Democratic Convention in 1984, waiting for my ride at midnight, and I was talking to the security guard there, and I said, so who are you going to vote for this year? And he said, well, I'm going to vote for Ronald Reagan. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. And then he said, but if I don't vote for Ronald Reagan, I'm going to vote for Jesse Jackson. And I was astonished because I couldn't think of two candidates more diametrically opposed in their platforms and what they stood for. So I said, well, how is it that these two candidates appeal to you? What is it about them? And he said, I may not agree with everything they say, but I believe that they're saying what they really think. And I think that's a powerful lesson. And Trump certainly learned that lesson, just came out kind of bombastic to say whatever he thought. and it resonated. Bernie Sanders kind of came out with whatever he thought. And two very, very different candidates were the most exciting and effective political candidates of 2016. And now we have so many of these candidates running at the state level and some of these congressional seats. It feels like some of the orthodoxy around who can run and what they can say is being broken open. Do you think that's true, or am I?
No, I believe that's the case, and I hope that's the case. You know, the essential nature of longstanding American political orthodoxy has been an overriding caution, and there's been no debate at all on several major issues. And this is why it's important, I think, that that veterans run, and that the issue of our foreign military misadventures is be addressed, because in so many ways the Democratic Party has sort of yielded the ground on these crazy forever wars. And if you pay attention to the veterans, there are many of them who say that this whole idea of support the troops, which the right throws at us to keep us from opposing war, is backwards. And if you truly support the troops, you won't put them in harm's way unless it's absolutely in the national interest and a just war. And I don't see many Democrats doing that, but I hope that some of these veterans who know well better will say that. And I hope that the puncturing of the political orthodoxy that Trump has done will encourage people on the left to talk about these forever wars and to talk about the war on drugs and to talk about health care for everybody, because those are important things that we've sort of left behind because politicians are cautious.
Right. Well, I think you laid out a fabulous program, and I hope somebody runs on your character in your novel on her program. It's, as you say, she's for the carbon tax, which is clearly the most sensible and effective way to reduce carbon emissions, because it gives the incentive for companies to do things in a way that reduces carbon. And it's not directing how they do it. It's just saying that's the goal. You figure out how you want to do it. She's got a program on combating inequality, providing universal education, health care for all, understanding the ineffectiveness of the war on drugs and how racist it's been, the importance of rethinking the war on terror, which is, like, as you talk about it, the forever war mentality. So it's a great program, but you haven't heard many of those things until 2016. And then we still haven't had the carbon tax, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But addressing inequality and providing a free college, pre-education up through college, and universal health care or Medicare for all, Bernie Sanders came out strongly for those in 2016, which I think has really kind of paved the way for a lot of people to come out with that whole Bernie Sanders agenda, which is really resonating with people. So I think some of what you talked about in the book, you've kind of laid the groundwork for, and is really picked up a lot of steam quickly.
I hope that's the case, and you've sort of laid out her program as well as I could, actually. The thing about a carbon tax is that there's probably few things that are as much of a silver bullet as that is. For one thing, there's obviously a social cost to carbon pollution, and the companies therefore are being subsidized because in the end, governments and people in healthcare pay the cost that they do not incur when they pollute, and that cost should be transferred to them. But also, it would not only be good for the environment, it's a foreign policy device because it would reduce our dependence on foreign oil, which is at the root of so many of these forever wars. And you know, we talk about infrastructure all the time, but your point is correct, and the point of my book is correct, that we ignore human infrastructure. And we're going to continue to have income inequality, and we're going to continue to fall behind other countries unless we educate our people. And if you were to take the cost of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and combined, you could educate every American by sending every American who wants to go to college to college for about 30 years. So, and I don't think that can be, that point can be driven home more than enough. It's just, it's unbelievable that money would be spent on material that we take overseas and blow up, when we could be improving the lives of poor people who would be benefited by having a college education.
Right, exactly. And imagine the impact we could have if we paid for books, not bombs, with our taxes.
Exactly.
And, yeah, well, and by the way, there's a great play you want to be on the lookout. I just went to the world premiere a couple of weeks ago in Virginia, written by John Henry, and he talks all about the roots of perpetual war going back all the way to President Woodrow Wilson and the whole mentality of, the war mentality. And it's fascinating, and the arrogation of the power by the president to declare war when actually constitutionally it's supposed to, that power is supposed to reside with the members of Congress. But Wilson arrogated it to himself, and so did pretty much every president thereafter. So it's a long-standing problem that we need to deal with. It's just like, really, what is that solving? And it's the level of waste of treasure and people and talent is just heartbreaking. But we can change that in the future. I remember I sat down once because, you know, I believe, as you do, in having, reducing the wealth inequality in the country and the great programs you lay out in your wonderful book there. But I sat down one day with the New York Times, did an outline of the federal budget, and I got my pencil and I said, all right, I'm going to figure out how we can balance this budget. And I set aside the day to do it. So I sat down, and I was done within 15 minutes. And the way I was done in 15 minutes was essentially to say, we restore fair taxes to the very wealthy and big business, and we cut subsidies to the corporations, and I would include the military budget, which is so vastly bloated and which is largely oriented towards the profits of the weapon companies much more than for the true defense of the United States. So if you take those steps, you free up trillions of dollars for everything else that we need. So it's actually a simple thing. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's actually pretty straightforward of how we can balance the budget and provide all these good programs we're talking about.
You're absolutely right. And in the book, Melinda Sherman says that these forever wars are directly related to inequality in itself for two reasons, one of which you just elucidated, which is, you know, who gets wealthy from that? And it's the large corporations that, you know, receive defense dollars, and it's their stockholders, and it's their officers, all of whom are fairly wealthy people. And the price of the war is paid for by taxpayers, largely middle-class taxpayers. But the human cost of the war is borne by the military classes of the United States, which are poor whites, poor blacks, and poor Hispanics, who, you know, see the military service as a reasonable way to get education and make a good living. When Nixon eliminated the draft, he created this volunteer service, which now makes all the military come from that same class. And the other problem is 99% of the country doesn't know people who go overseas and lose arms and legs and lives and become traumatized by war. And it would be much, much different if we had a universal service and everybody either had to do Peace Corps or be in the Army, and they would know the pain, the human suffering of these wars, and they wouldn't happen, or they would be much less likely to happen.
Right, and actually, and even a simple thing of having the family members of people in Congress go to war. And the only one I know who's in Congress right now who did that was he's actually not even in Congress anymore, but Senator Joe Biden. His son, Beau, went over to serve in Iraq. But generally, the sons and daughters of members of Congress somehow end up not on the field of battle. But I think that could change things pretty quickly, too. You know, I want to go back to this issue of the carbon tax because it's got a very, very interesting and important sort of history behind it, that the main opponents of the carbon tax, as it is by far and away, anybody who seriously studies this issue knows that a carbon tax is the best way to deal with the problem of carbon emissions and the problems of global climate change and should be done. So what is stopping it? Well, what's stopping it is the Koch brothers, who made their mega fortune through fossil fuels and including oil, just rabid against the carbon tax. And they actually made an alliance with the tobacco companies, and they said, look, we, the Koch brothers, are against the carbon tax, but we want to cover it in this whole veneer and say, well, we're against all taxes because we don't want to just be looking self-interested around carbon. We'll just say it's an ideological principle position. We're against all taxes. And they said to the tobacco companies, and you want to oppose all the taxes on cigarettes, which, you know, people want to tax the cigarettes to pay for the health for the millions of people who get sick and die from smoking cigarettes. Said, but don't just come out against cigarette taxes. You too can come out against all taxes, and we'll join together and just support candidates who are against all taxes. And there was that unholy alliance was formed back about 25 years ago. It's all written up by one of the men who was actually in on the conversations and then kind of had a change of heart and said, you know, this is really bad. This is damaging to our country, damaging to our environment. People are dying from this. So he wrote a book exposing what the Koch brothers were up to. But I think no one bears greater responsibility for blocking the carbon tax than the Koch brothers.
Oh, absolutely. And they're deleterious, nefarious effect on our democratic government goes far beyond that. I am actually, my Yale classmate, Jane Mayer, wrote a book called Dark Money, which is an incredible explication of how they put together these combination of think tanks, people on television and radio, and super PACs to sort of push their agenda and basically create the Tea Party, which everybody thinks was a reaction against Washington, but it was really a Koch brothers-funded anti-tax, anti-government movement. And they have done quite a bit. And I also have another classmate, Sheldon Whitehouse, who's a senator from Rhode Island, and he wrote a book as well about it. And he said to see it up close is just unbelievable, because the Republican members, who used to be a very vibrant party and have differences of opinion on various things, now are all lockstep on the Koch brothers' position. And you should look back. You know, like Richard Nixon created the EPA and he created OSHA. And you know, Republicans have not really been all that bad until the Koch brothers really scared the heck out of these Republicans about primaries and about funds going against them. So then now they're all lockstep, out to kill the environment, out to prevent taxes being spent on environmental care and things like that. It's one of the saddest things. I mean, Trump is scary, but the Koch brothers are probably even scarier.
Yeah, well said. And I recommend that book, Dark Money, to the listeners. It's the best book I've seen describing the kind of in behind the scenes, all the big money from the giant corporations that's come in to distort our politics, our government. It's distorting our media. It's distorting even academia now, as the Koch brothers have been funding universities, even the liberal New England universities, with their money. So it's important to know about that. So we just have 2 minutes left here, and I'm wondering what you think our listeners can do. I mean, given all of what we're talking about, the importance of the program you mentioned, the general dangers of caution as the ideology for most politicians, whatever their party, but now kind of the sun peeking through and some very strong, unorthodox, and outspoken candidates are popping up all over the country, what do you think our listeners can do to help promote the kind of progressive program that you went into Congress to support and that you write about in your book? What can we do to make that happen now?
I think the answer is in the fact that so many people who are on our side of the issues did not vote and do not vote. And one of the positive byproducts of this whole Trump circus, I think, is that a lot of people think about politics every day. And I mean, I was involved in politics for years, and then I was no longer involved in it, and I never thought about it all that much once I got out of it. But now I think about it more than I did when I was actually involved in it, because it's clearly so critical to our nation, to our republic, to our status in the world, to the environment, to what happens with income inequality. We can see it being destroyed in front of us. So I would say you just vote, organize to vote, get as many people as you can to register. And they're trying to take this right away from us with voter ID laws and other things. So it's really, really important. I can't stress that enough. And I hope that it is a positive byproduct of the Trump thing. And then the other thing, I think, is that people have to demand more progressive, openly liberal policies that have never been talked about in the Congress or in the national debate by Democrats, including the carbon tax and universal education and health care and, you know, these foreign wars and the war on drugs and things like that. There's never really been a true debate about that, and I think we need to demand those things. But more importantly, we just got to get out there and vote. And when you see that 50% or 60% of the people aren't voting, that's the answer.
That's it. We have the power. Let's use it. So that's all the time we have. Gerald Weaver, thank you so much for being on All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate it.